Good morning and good evening, participants, and a very warm welcome to the South Asia podcast conference session in the South Asia chart. In a conversation hosted by the Institute of South Asian Studies with Professor Sanjay Chakravarty. So Professor Chakravarty is the Professor of Geography and Urban Studies and Global Studies at the Temple University of Philadelphia in the United States of America. And he's also the Director of the Center for Global Studies at the university. Professor Chakravarty, a very warm welcome to today's conversation. And today we are going to discuss the forthcoming presidential elections in the United States of America, and with a very specific focus on how the Indian diaspora or India at large is occupying a prominent position in the run-up to the elections among the main parties and candidates contesting the elections, and how India as such has become more prominent over the years in the political discourse in the United States of America, particularly its diaspora. So with that little very brief introduction, let me now begin this conversation straight away. Professor Chakravarty, let me begin by asking you this first question with less than 2 months to go for the presidential elections. It appears from the public projections that are available till now that the Democrat nominee Joe Biden is having a fairly certain advantage over his Republican candidate, Mr. Trump. But we have seen that in past, such forecasts, such predictions have actually not turned out to be fully correct, which could be partly because of the fact that the popular feelings among the electorate don't get entirely reflected in the conclusions that have determined the presidential elections. And there is this fairly complicated system of an electoral college and the swing states and the role they play. But on the whole, what is your take on the likely outcome for the elections? Do you think the Democrats have an advantage this time? Over to you, Professor Chakravarty.
Yeah, you put it very well, Amitindu. The polling does suggest that Biden has an advantage, certainly in the nationwide poll. And it is almost certain that he is going to win the popular vote. So he's going to get more votes. That will not necessarily make him a winner, because as you noted, there is the complication of the Electoral College. And that really makes this election relevant to 6 to 8 states. It's not a national election. It's a very strange form of democracy, as you know, they have over here. Now, those 6 to 8 states, they're being polled quite heavily. And the question is whether the polls are accurate, whether they're capturing public sentiment, whether they're capturing public preferences. And we don't know that. We do know that last election, which was the shocker, was decided in a couple of states by a mere handful of votes. It could have gone either way. It was just, you know, some people chose to stay home, some people chose to come out. It seems that those states have woken up to the possibility that this could be very, very close. And so, for instance, the state you visited, Pennsylvania, the state in which I live, Donald Trump won that state by 44,000 votes. That was 0.7% of the people who voted, not the electorate, of the people who voted. So it was a very, very slim margin. Michigan, he won by 13,000 votes. It's really nothing. It's Can these be turned around? Polling seems to suggest in these two states in particular that Joe Biden has a pretty strong grip on these. There are other states that are closer. So it really is going to depend on mail-in voting. It's going to depend on election day, of course, who shows up. But a lot will depend on mail-in voting this time. Because of the pandemic scare, a lot of people, especially elderly people, don't want to show up to polling booths. Early voting has already begun in places, and the lines are long. We shall see. I mean, in the past several years, not more than 58%, 58% of the electorate has voted, even in the last one when interest was so high. If that changes to 65, all bets are off, really. I mean, who actually motivates and gets their voters out will be really, really important.
I think it's
a non-answer of sorts, yeah. But...
Professor Chakravarti, you lay out the landscape very well, because I think there is this very prominent sense of uncertainty as the final election day, the voting day, the key November day comes close. But moving beyond the outcome, let's assume that we have a Joe Biden presidency staring at us from 2021. And when we compare that outcome with respect to a country like India, and we have seen several remarkable developments in the last 4 years of the Trump presidency with respect to the India-United States relations, how do you expect a Biden presidency will be for India? In what ways specifically might it be different from India?
That's an interesting question. That is really complicated by Kamala Harris, because there is an very unusually strong India presence on this ticket. This is unexpected. It's historic, actually. It's unprecedented. Now, you may have noted that Kamala Harris is not particularly beloved by the Indian right, because she tends to point to things like rights of minorities and the government's actions in Kashmir. And if she continues to do that, it is possible that relations could get a little tense. But I have seen that candidates are very different from occupants of the White House. Yeah. So in order to occupy the position, people say certain things that they do not necessarily follow up on or back up once they have the power. Because my sense is that the India-US relationship is on roughly even keel for the last 20 odd years or so, through the first NDA, the two UPAs, then NDA again. It is a relationship that is built on mutual benefit, I think. And I doubt that either party is gonna get too serious about scoring debating points about who has better human rights, or I just don't see much of that happening, which is one of the reasons that, as you pointed out in a conversation with me, that the BJP has asked its USA affiliates to not use the party name when they endorse a candidate. They do not wish to be seen to be taking sides on this one. And I suspect a similar sentiment prevails on the Democratic side of the ticket.
I think that's a very important point that you make, Shanjay. In fact, I would like to revisit that later in our conversation. But before that, I wanted to take up another thought with you, that you have been studying the Indian diaspora closely. You're an author of The Other 1% in America, which you wrote along with Devesh Kapoor and Nirvika Singh. Now, why do you think over the years the Indian diaspora has become an important factor in the United States elections? What to you are the main reasons behind this importance?
Well, you know what, Amitendra, that's a very interesting question. In our book, actually, we wrote that they are not very important in American presidential elections. And our reasoning was that they are concentrated in states which are heavily Democratic. So California, New Jersey, New York. And as a result, their numbers get diluted. As it is, you know, it's a small number. Their numbers get diluted. It doesn't have that impact. But the numbers keep increasing. When we wrote the book, which was, you know, roughly 5 years ago, is when we wrote it. The population was roughly 1%, and a more recent check of the numbers suggests that, you know, it's actually gone up from there, which we said, we wrote in the book, that in 20 years, if somebody writes this book again, it should be the other 2%, because it's given demographic trends, Indians could be that large. So the numbers have changed. The other thing that is not new, but is becoming stronger, is that I mentioned Pennsylvania and Michigan earlier, right? And the very narrow margins of victory by Trump in those two states. Remember, Pennsylvania 44,000, Michigan 13,000. Now, in Michigan, my rough calculations show that the Indian-born electorate, people who were born in India, are American citizens now. There is roughly 40,000 people. And roughly 60,000 people were either born in India or have Indian parentage. They're in Michigan. This in a state where the margin of victory or defeat was 13,000. This is a critical number. Now 40 and 60,000 now becomes an important number.
Right.
Similarly, in Pennsylvania, the numbers of Indians are 50,000 that are born in India but are American citizens now, are eligible to vote, and roughly 75,000 using two generations. And the margin of defeat over here was 44,000. They could actually play a pivotal role in swinging two swing states.
Right.
This time it matters.
In fact, that I think is increasingly turning out to be crucial. I mean, you mentioned the numbers in so-called tight states, or states which eventually become crucial in determining the final outcome. Yes, I mean, coming from India, we all know that small numbers in tight elections, in marginal outcomes, make a very big difference. So the Indians are living up to their reputation, I would say, in that case of contributing to tight finishes. But in that respect, you alluded to Kamala Harris before. And this is something which is very interesting, because Kamala Harris, insofar as her nomination is concerned, as far as the rest of the world is also concerned too, including India, brings a very prominent Indian face to the American elections, which I think is distinct by the impact that it makes, at least in terms of the optics and the visuals. But as such, do you think her presence and her nomination is going to make a difference to the way Indians are going to vote in the current election?
Honestly, Amitendra, I don't know. There are two kind of forces at play over here that I'm noticing. One is, first of all, the Indians are the most heavily Democratic voters among all groups other than African Americans, right? So in the last three elections, Indians, as far as we can estimate, the Indian votes for the Democratic Party went roughly 80% and above. So they vote heavily democratically, way more than all other Asian groups, way more than all other groups, except, as I said, African Americans. Now, the question is whether Kamala Harris's presence on the ticket solidifies this 80% or weakens it. And I am seeing some tendencies, and this may be because I'm spying on the wrong kind of WhatsApp groups. I'm kind of nosing around here and there, trying to listen, eavesdrop on people, and figure out what they're saying, what they're thinking. And there's quite a little bit of groundswell of opinion against her because of, once again, the Kashmir and the minority issue. Will it be enough to change the 80-20 breakup? I'm not sure that it will. But it is not as clear a slam dunk as one would have imagined that, okay, the 80 is now going to turn to 100. It probably won't turn to 100. It probably will remain roughly in that region. I mean, there was a poll that was reported in all the papers, actually, in India, the Times of India, Hind, everybody reported, which supposedly showed that the vote is splitting two-thirds, one-thirds, two-thirds for Biden, Indian vote, two-thirds for Biden, one-third for the for Trump. Now, if that is the case, if that poll is accurate, then there's actually a loss of Indian votes for Democrats. I don't know what the methodology is of that poll. So yes, 80% is a lot. Can it be more? I doubt it.
I think it's a very interesting dynamic that's emerging. And the dynamic is also in a way contributing to the fact that there is a fairly sharp and nuanced polarization among voters on very specific issues insofar as their preferences for candidates are concerned. And this is in fact something which I think is becoming a bit of a hallmark of the Indian American community in the United States, because you raised Kashmir, you mentioned human rights. Kashmir, as has always been a major point of conversation in India, but given the fact that there was a scrapping of Article 370 last year by the BJP government, it's become an even more contested frame. There have been other legislations in India which have been controversial, implemented by the current government, which have almost nearly horizontally split Indians into various groups. Now, do you see the Indian American community in the US as well kind of getting split on those broad lines? Because I would assume that most of them are well connected to the developments in India that are going on. They are following those closely in today's world of social media, for example. So is that also creating blocks within the community along the lines of the divisions that we are experiencing in India, political and social divisions? And is that going to influence their voting in any way?
That's a very interesting and difficult question. And I can give you my best guess. My sense is that the Indian community over here is Indian by passport only. It is not Indian by some kind of national identity. I think my sense is that they are Tamil, Telugu, Gujarati, Bengali, etc. first, before there are very few Indian associations over here, but you have language associations and religious associations are much more abundant. It is not a melting pot as far as Indians are concerned. It is very much more of a salad bowl, and the pieces are quite separate from each other. And given that the really rising numbers of Indians, I mean, this new demographic shift, the reason that prompted us to write the book, the demographic shift was driven really by South Indians, by Telugu and Tamil, massive influx that has weakened the Gujarati Punjabi, which was more conservative, which is even now tends to lean more Republican, which also tends to lean more BJP in India. Yeah. That has demographically weakened, whereas the South Indian blocs, particularly Tamil, Telugu, I don't see that they share the same Kashmir, NRC citizenship issues that the Modi central government likes to put front and center. I don't see that the politics actually, in a sense, the politics back home, the regional politics back home, tends to get reflected over here in that the issues that are national issues or are made into national issues, like NRC and Article 370, I do not see them resonating as much as regional, more language-driven issues. That is what people tend to talk about by and large.
Right.
So as a result, the politics of India tends to get played out in very similar ways, in the same sense that, you know, Bengal, Gujarat, and Tamil Nadu had such separate political dynamics.
Sure.
It's very hard to draw any conclusion by looking at those three states. I suspect to a very similar extent, the Gujarati, Bengali, and Tamil communities over here have dynamics that really don't relate necessarily strongly to the Indian dynamics, so to speak.
Very interesting, Sanjay. And in fact, this is a point on which I would like to probably ask you my concluding question of this conversation on a subject that has remained a prominent part of the India-US conversation for several years. And I allude to the H-1B visas. You know, it was obvious that soon after Trump stopped this executive order issued a couple of months ago, stopping the H-1B visas till the end of the year, immediately followed by very angry reactions coming out of the Silicon Valley, the tech industry. No doubt you alluded to the fact that there's been a very large migration and presence of skilled Indians, particularly in the tech and IT sector, who are populating the Silicon Valley. But also, Joe Biden didn't lose much time in translating that to a potential political advantage by saying that this is a wrong step. And if he gets to be in the White House, he will turn this down immediately. So I would probably, as an outsider, tend to think, and I might be completely wrong in this regard, that the position that US administrations take on H-1B visas, to an extent, makes them preferable or less preferable to the Indian voters in the United States, a large part of them. Do you think that matters?
You would think it matters, right? Okay. You would think that racism matters. You would think that it is obvious that we are not white, we are brown, we are dark, and that a party that is now more openly racist than I have seen, than really anybody has seen in 40, 50 years, would attract almost no support from Indians, you would think. And yet, there you have it. At least 20%, and according to this poll, maybe one third, do support Trump. There is no kind of second guessing people's rationalities. The H-1 visa, of course, is of supreme importance, especially to the recent immigrants, to the IT sector. It is of supreme importance to the tech industry, which is backing Biden in a big way. I mean, 95-5, somewhere in that range. It's a big fundraising source for him. So yes, the stars are aligned with Biden as far as H-1B and tech are concerned. But the fact that these do not seem to affect the preference of a substantial minority of Indian voters is one that, you know, continues to puzzle you and me, but there it is, there you have it.
I think that's ironical, Sanjay, because I think, as we have all realized over time by looking at the social responses and the economic motivations behind social responses shaping political decisions, there are really know homogeneous behavioral patterns, and these are becoming more and more complicated over time. And I think the Indian diaspora, in a sense, apart from the skills and attributes and the tremendous volume of wealth and knowledge that it has brought to the United States of America, it's also brought with it a phenomenal degree of complications, which are very, very attractive for people like you and me, the scholars who tend to look at various issues for making our advances intellectually in a scholarly fashion. It's become that much more difficult to predict what will happen in the elections. On that note, thank you so much. Really can't thank you enough for joining us in this conversation at what we know is an inconvenient time for you, pretty late in the evening out there. Thank you so much. Listeners, that was Professor Sanjay Chakravarty in conversation in the South Asia Chat series of the Institute of South Asian Studies in the National University of Singapore. Thank you so much for tuning in to South Asia Chat. If you wish to know more about our work at ISAS, please visit us at www.isas.nus.edu.sg. Good morning, good evening, and good night, depending on wherever you are, in which part of the world. Stay safe and take care. Thank you.